Open your Bibles with me, guys, to 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel 17. We're going to tackle this entire chapter today. So, 1 Samuel 17. And the title of the sermon is simply David and Goliath. David and Goliath. Well, guys, it may be that this is the most famous chapter of the entire Old Testament. Someone may be as far away from Christianity as possible, and yet they probably still have heard about David and Goliath. This is a very famous chapter. Yet the problem is that most of the time, people get the message of the chapter wrong. Usually, when this text is presented to people, the message is that, well, you need to be bold, and you need to be brave, and you need to be courageous like David. You need to be like David, and you are David in the story, and you need to defeat your giants, right? You need to defeat your own Goliath. You need to go grab your five smooth stones from your brook, you know, which are like, you know, prayer and meditation and Bible reading and stuff like that. And you need to strike your giant down, and that's what you got to do. That's usually the message that people give when they study this chapter, but that's obviously not the message here. And to understand the real message of 1 Samuel 17, we need to, first of all, I think, understand what the chapter would have meant to the original readers. If you remember, the context of the book is the utter need of what? The utter need of what? A king. That's exactly right. A king. A righteous king. And we have been waiting for this righteous king since Judges, when we read that in those days there was no king in Israel, right? And everyone did what was right in their own eyes, right? And throughout the book, we've been asking three questions over and over again, or at least I have. Will that king come? Who will that king be? And will he solve Israel's problems? And we have seen that the answer to that, to the coming of this king is separated in two with two individuals. There's two individuals in view. First, there's a human king, and that's going to be David, right? A king who will come, and he will solve Israel's problem, which is the Philistines are here. They are oppressing Israel. They need a king who will deliver them from their enemies, right? And he's going to do that. But ultimately, we have another figure, and that is the ultimate king, who will also come, and he will not only solve the problem of Israel, he will solve the problem of the entire world, which is what? Piper? Sin, yeah. Sin, death, the result of sin, the wrath of God, the judgment of God, right? And so David is a type, a picture, a shadow of this ultimate king who's gonna come. But for this ultimate king to come, Christ, this earthly king has to come, or this one king who is only human has to come, and that is David. And in this chapter that we're going to study today is incredibly important because it presents to us the introduction of David to the world as this momentary king that this book is in search of. Chapter 16, we already studied that. It introduced David privately. Only his brothers were there, right? But now he's about to be introduced to the world, to Israel, and to all of us as the king that this book is searching for. And so this chapter is special, not only because the story is really cool. It is, but it's special because for the first time, the king we've been waiting for arrives. The king who delivers his people from their enemies. And yet before David can reign, before he can be revealed as a king, he has to fulfill a mission, just like Saul. Y'all remember that in chapter 13? He had to fulfill a mission. David has to fulfill a mission. He has a battle that he has to fight. He has a battle that he has to win, and he has to win it to show and make manifest that God is with him, because ultimately that's this battle that we're going to study is between God and Goliath, not David in the end, not Israel. It's going to be between God and the gods of the Philistines we're going to see. God, David has to show that he is a man who walks with God, and God has to deliver him and strengthen him. And so rather than pushing us to be like David, rather than pushing us to trust in ourselves and defeating our own giants, the timeless truth that this passage presents to us is, I would say, that God is capable to defeat our giants. So that's what this chapter is about. It's about God, not us. It's about God and his power, not David and how cool he is and how he can slay giants. So it's about God. Who knows that children's song that says, My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do. It goes like that, right? Yeah, okay, well, this chapter provides that song with its theology. That's what this chapter's about. That my God is so big, he's so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do. There's no giant he cannot defeat, no stronghold he cannot break, nothing he cannot deliver me from. So this chapter is a chapter that exalts God as the giant slayer and as he who delivers us from our greatest of threats, just as he will deliver David and Israel from Goliath. Now, as I said, this story presents to us a battle. And if there is a battle, then there has to be fighters. So let's use the three fighters that this chapter presents to us to form our outline. So let's start with fighter number one. And fighters usually have really cool names, so we're going to give Goliath a cool name. So this is our first fighter, Goliath, comma, the metal giant. Goliath, the metal giant. Look at verse 1 with me. It says, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. And they camped between Soko and Azekah in Ephesdamim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them." So you have one army on a hill, and you have the other army on another hill, and between them there's this valley, and the setting is being prepared for us to expect a mighty war that's going to take place, that's going to make history, all right? And I want you to notice just how the narrator tells the story. He's trying to make you almost sit back and like have a lot of expectation and like get your popcorn and get ready for an awesome fight. But before we see the fight, we need to first be introduced to the fighters. And so, for a second, the narrator becomes a boxing announcer. And it's like he grabs the mic, and he's like, "On the left side, the Philistines' champion, the Philistines' lucky charm, the Philistines' secret weapon, Goliath!" And it's like everyone goes crazy. Look at verse 4. That's exactly what happens. Then the champion, verse 4, "Then the champion came out from the armies of the Philistines, named Goliath from Gath." Now, what we're about to read, guys, is meant to intimidate you. So just imagine. Again, I mean, like, just imagine. It's a boxing match, right? So Goliath is coming out. You know, you know how like they put the rock music in the background, so you can almost hear. You know, like da 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 da. Da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, like just imagine it. He's coming out, and the crowd is going crazy. It's like, that's our warrior. That's what the Philistines are saying. Anyways, and the crowd is going crazy. And before we study Goliath's description, I want you to notice something in this word that the narrator uses to describe Goliath. He uses the word champion. Champion. Champion here literally means the man of the between. Write that down. It's important. The man of the between. That's how it's translated. And it refers to a warrior who stands between one army and another to rescue his people. He was a representative of his people. And historically, such champions would place themselves in face-to-face combat, in duels, to you could say, rather than having to have a war, rather than many people dying, they would just pick the strongest men, the one who would represent the army, and they would stand in the valley, and the other army would pick another champion, another strong man, and they would just fight to the death. And whoever won, that army defeated the other army, and now the losing army who lost would have had to serve them. That's how they settled war sometimes back then. And so a better way to put this is that the man of the between is the mediator and the representative of his people. The mediator and the representative of his people. And I hope that rings a bell. I hope that reminds you of something that we're about to see in a little bit. But anyways, that's what Goliath was to the Philistines. And then the narrator begins to describe him for us. Again, the rock music is in the background. Look at verse 4 again. It says, "Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose weight was 6 cubits in a span." That's almost 10 feet tall. It's almost 10 feet tall. So this is a giant. He's humongous. He's 3 feet taller than Shaq. Y'all, it's like, that's crazy. It's like you're trying to look at the sun and you can't because his face just blocks it. He's tall. And this is a giant, all right? And the moment we find a giant, my question is, well, where did this giant come from? And it's interesting because the Bible actually presents to us a history of Goliath. It's really interesting. And we could actually start all the way back from Genesis 6, but for the sake of time, let's begin in Numbers 13. Numbers 13. So you don't have to go there. I'm probably going to go super fast here because there's like 58 verses in this chapter. But who can remind me what happens in Numbers 13 when the... Hold on. When they get to the promised land, right? And Moses sends the spies. And they come back and they're afraid. What do they find in the promised land? Giants, yes. And so they come back and they're like, except two of them. Two of them were faithful. Two of them trusted God. But everybody else is like, Moses, the Nephilim are there. That's literally what they say. They call them the Nephilim. Giants are there and we're like grasshoppers in their sight. It's like they're just going to squish us. They're going to kill us and take our family. And it was exactly for that reason, by the way, that that God punished them and made them walk for 40 years in the desert because they feared giants more than they trusted God. But anyways, more history happens, and then we come to Joshua 15 and see that once they had taken possession of the promised land, Joshua divides the land. So 45 years have passed. Remember, Joshua and Caleb were the only faithful spies, right? And so now he's allotting land to Caleb. And in Joshua 15, verse 14, it says this, that Caleb drove out from there the children of Anak. Those are giants. And so Caleb drives these giants out of Canaan, and therefore the giants who survived were now fugitives, confined to find refuge in certain Philistine cities nearby, one of which was Gath, which is where Goliath is from. And so Goliath is a descendant of fugitive giants who were driven out from their homeland by Caleb in Joshua 15. And also, if you remember, Gath was one of the cities that was judged by God when they were passing the ark around, right? And so you got to understand, Goliath knows who these people are. There's history here. He's had beef with them since he was little. Goliath would have probably wondered his whole life. It's like, why is it that I live amongst midgets? Why is it that we live with the Philistines? Oh, it's because the people of God, the Jews, drove my family and my people out of my home. So Goliath, he's not neutral here. He's probably been waiting his entire life to fight and kill the people of God. That's where he comes from. Now let's keep going in the text. The narrator now begins to describe Goliath's armor. Verse 5. He, Goliath, had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. This is a mail coat, sort of like the cool shirt that Frodo gives Bilbo. No. Bilbo gives Frodo. My bad. What? Yeah, okay, thank you. Thank you. Alrighty. Bilbo gives Frodo a really cool male shirt. And so that's exactly what he has. The only difference is that this shirt weighs 126 pounds. And so that's pretty crazy. Verse 6. He also had bronze greaves on his legs and a bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. So this is a giant covered with bronze. This is a metal giant. Verse 7. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, meaning that his spear was so thick you couldn't even hold it with your hands, but he could because he's a giant. And it says that the head of his spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. That's 15.1 pounds just for the head of the spear. And lastly, we're told that his shield carrier also walked before him. So he had like 200 pounds of armor on him, and his shield was so heavy that he needed an extra person just to carry it. And what's the point of all of this? that he was terrifying. That he was terrifying. Now let's look at what this metal giant had to say. Verse 8. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine?" Not by blood, he wasn't. "And you servants of Saul?" And notice this. Notice what he says. "Choose some men for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us." Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." "Pick a man," Goliath says, "your strongest man, your greatest man, your knight of knights and soldier of soldiers, a champion that he would fight with me, a man of the between for Israel who will fight with me and see who can win. Pick a man who will be the mediator and representative and savior of his people." It's like, guys, this is exactly what this book has been crying out for. This king, this protector, this savior. And by the way, these words of Goliath, this is exactly what the entire Bible is crying out for. For a Messiah, a savior who will come and who will stand in the between of God's people and the wrath of God. It's amazing, amazing. But to not get ahead of myself, look at how everyone responded in verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. How tragic. How tragic. And again, if the theme of our passage is that God is capable to defeat our giants, we need to look at Goliath, who was supposed to be the giant of giants, the picture of the most invincible thing in the world. We need to look at that and ask the question, can God defeat this giant? And the obvious answer is what? Yes. Yes, he can defeat this giant. And God is so powerful and capable, and he's capable, and he's so strong and so mighty that to take him down, he's going to use the most unlikely person he could use. And so we come to our second fighter in the story. Goliath has been presented in the ring, and the narrator now turns and says, "For our second fighter, David!" And nobody claps. Nobody claps. Nobody claps. In fact, the way he's described is so ironic that I'm going to title this second fighter, David, comma, the Hobbit. David the Hobbit. I mean, this is just so much like Lord of the Rings, I think. You have an insurmountable threat of death in the horizon, and then the narrator now moves us to the peaceful, humble, childlike Shire. And there you spot him, the Hobbit who will save the day. Look at verse 12. That's exactly what happens. 12. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in the days of Saul, advanced in years among men. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, and the second to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. Now verse 14. David was the youngest. Stop there. Notice how David and his family are introduced a second time. And that's weird because it's like he's acting as if we didn't know who these people were, even though he introduced them to us in the last chapter. And what makes it weirder is that we're gonna see that not even Saul recognizes David. And I think that the reason for this is most likely that there is a break of a couple of years between chapter 16 and 17. So it seems that Saul let go of David as his harp player, and David just returned to his father to help him as a shepherd. And enough years had passed so that now he wasn't recognizable by Saul. So you could say that in chapter 16 he was the harp playing middle schooler, and in chapter 17 he's a 17-year-old teenager. Okay, so 17-year-old high schooler. Now look at verse 14 again. It says, David was the youngest. Now, the 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's flock at Bethlehem. This gives us another clue as to why David was sent back. there was a time of war. It was time of war, right? And so at this time, Saul needed warriors more than he needed a harp player. And in taking the warriors and taking Jesse's sons, he's taking Jesse's workers. So in a sense, there's an exchange. It's like, all right, I'll give you your son back, your harp-playing son back, and you give me your sons. There you go. So that David could now continue helping his dad do his work while his other three sons are at war. Now, I want you to think of this. This is about David is about to be introduced publicly as the mighty warrior and ruler, and yet so far all that we've heard of him is that he's a shepherd boy. He's a shepherd boy. He's not from a royal line. He's not a big shot. He's not in war, so that means that he has no military experience. He's an underdog, you could say, a rookie, and that reminds you of a theme we've been coming to again and again throughout the book of 1 Samuel, and that is that God uses the lowly and the humble and the meek and the small things of the world to show his power. And furthermore, I think this introduction of David also shows us that God uses the faithful. The faithful in the little things, let's put it that way. He usually doesn't use the mighty. He usually doesn't use the influential. He uses those who are content to faithfully serve God in the background. And that's exactly what we see David doing. He proved to be faithful in the little, you could even say almost insignificant things before he would be given the bigger responsibility of ruling a kingdom. Now, let's look at the circumstances that David found himself in. Look at verse 16. It says, the Philistine, Goliath, came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. So for 40 days, twice a day, Goliath is just coming out and saying the exact same thing. Give me a champion. Where is your champion? Where is your men of the between? And so he would just get up in the morning, have breakfast, and he would go out and say the same thing. Then he would have dinner and do the exact same thing for 40 days. And by the way, notice the number 40. Number 40 is a representation of a time of testing. And so this is a test for Israel. Will they trust God? Will they trust God? And so Goliath keeps doing this, and Jesse and David being far away, they have no idea that this is going on. And it seems that one day Jesse seems to have become anxious for his sons who are at war. Because look at what he decides to do in verse 17. 17, it says, then Jesse said to David, his son, take now for your brothers an ephah of this roasted grain and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to your brothers. Bring also these 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000 and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. For Saul and they and all the men of Israel are in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistine, with the Philistines. That's actually not what they were doing. They were being cowards. But essentially, Jesse tells David to walk to the battlefield, to deliver some sandwiches, some cheese, whatever it was, 15 miles, by the way, and to bring back news of his brothers. And that, guys, is the setting that God is going to use to introduce David as the man of the between. That's the setting. And so we learn not only that God uses the nobodies of the world and the faithful, but we also learn that sometimes God acts in the times when you least expect it. Sometimes God acts in the times when you least expect it. Or as a commentator put it, he says this, ordinary situations can be the beginning of extraordinary things. I love that. Ordinary situations can be the beginning of extraordinary things. Now look at verse 20. What did David do? It says, so David arose early in the morning and left the flock with a keeper and took the supplies and went as Jesse had commanded him. This verse alone, by the way, is filled with good qualities about David. First of all, he got up early in the morning to do his job. So he's obedient. He obeys right away. Secondly, it says that he left the flock with a keeper and took his supplies. So he's responsible. And thirdly, it says that he went as Jesse had commanded him. And I think this shows not only his obedience, but his humility. So David is an obedient, responsible, humble king, unlike Saul, who had failed in every one of these areas. And again, I mean, you also have to put yourself in David's shoes. David knew that by now he was going to be king one day, and He's being commanded by his dad. He's about to be treated badly by his brothers. And he doesn't say, listen, you fools, you serve me now. Like, I'm going to be king, okay? And you better hope that you don't find me in a bad mood, because one of these days I'm going to be able to send you to the dungeons, you know? Like, he doesn't say that. He doesn't say that. He simply continues to do his duties faithfully. Now, keep reading into the second half of verse 20. It says, and he came to the circle of the camp while the army was going out in battle array, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. Then David left his baggage in the care of the baggage keeper and ran to the battle line and entered in order to greet his brothers. Verse 23, as he was talking with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath, named Goliath, was coming up from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them. And the moment he heard them, history was about to be made. It became the wake-up call for David, the call to take action, the opportunity of a lifetime. David is about to act. And after he acts, history will never be the same, because he's about to act and prove that he is the king we've been waiting for. And as we begin studying verses 24 and 26, we are presented not only with how David responds, but also with the perfect illustration of what it means to be a man after God's own heart. Listen, David is presented in this chapter as someone who has a completely different perspective than everybody else. He sees differently than everybody else. His brain is wired differently than everybody else. His perspective is different. And I think that that is the main quality that he has, which separates him from everybody else, which shows that he is a man after God's own heart. And so in light of this chapter, I think that to be a man or a woman after God's own heart is this. It is to see as God sees. To see as God sees, or even better, to have a heart that reflects God's own heart. To see as God sees, or to have a heart that reflects God's own heart. And there's a commentator that says that chapter 17 works to illustrate the theology of chapter 16. In chapter 16, we learn that man looks at what? The physical appearance or the heart? Physical appearance, right? But God looks at what? At the heart. And so we come to David, and that's exactly what we see him do. He does not look at the physical appearance. He looks at the heart. He sees as God sees. Let me show you. Look at verse 24. When all the men of Israel saw the man, Goliath, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. So it's interesting here, too, because verse 11 says that they were terrified by what they heard. And here it says that they were terrified by what they saw. And there's an emphasis here on the senses. They see as man sees. Physical appearance. So they are hearing and seeing as man sees, not as God sees. Verse 25. The men of Israel said, have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. 26. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine? That's an insult, by the way. That he should taunt the armies of the living God. The people answered him in accord with this word, saying, thus it will be done for the man who kills him. So David is in the midst of chaos. Everybody's running around. They're afraid. They feel like ants, and this giant is about to step on them. And while this is going on, David hears this offer that Saul is making. And the offer is this. Whoever kills Goliath, Saul is saying, I will give him my daughter, the princess, which is messed up, by the way, riches and no taxes. The girl, riches, no taxes. And most 17-year-old guys would be like, "Woo-hoo, that's a deal," you know? But that's not what David does. That is not how David responded. Look at how he responded. He hears both the reward of Saul and the taunting of Goliath, and yet he responds opposite to everyone else. The reward does nothing on him. He doesn't care about it. But the taunting of Goliath is what drives him to anger, into motivation to act. And he asks again what reward Saul is giving out, because he seems to not understand why Saul has to place a bait for the men to run and fight. It's as if he were saying, is there not a cost to fight? Is the glory of God not enough for you to stand and fight? Do you need anything else? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? And notice that in saying that, David doesn't even mention that Goliath is a giant. It's almost as if he hadn't even noticed. His height is irrelevant to him. So he sees that God is the living God, and therefore he sees that God is the real giant in the story, and that Goliath is nothing. He's nothing. And notice the contrast even in the words used in verses 25 and 26. In verse 25, the people called Goliath this man, while in verse 26, David calls him this uncircumcised Philistine. In verse 25, they say Goliath comes up to defy Israel, while in verse 26, David says that he taunts the armies of the living God. And then in verse 25, they speak of the man who kills him, while in verse 26, David speaks of the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach of Israel. And so, I mean, do you see the difference? He's seeing differently than everybody else. He saw the way God saw. He had a heart that reflected God's heart. And it is that very heart, that very way that he saw, that made him a man after God's own heart. By the way, you have to stop there for a little bit and make the point, and just meditate on the point that what drove him to anger again is that God was being offended by Goliath. We're going to learn in a little bit, as I mentioned, that this is a war between the Philistines' gods and Goliath. And he hears this, and it's almost as if he cannot stand it. And I want to ask you guys, how do you respond when God is mocked? How do you respond when God is offended, whether it's by you or anybody else? How do you respond? David wrote later on, "Zeal for your house is eating me up." In other words, zeal for your glory consumes me. Does zeal for his glory consume you? Is that the foundation of your emotions? Is that what drives you? Do you ever have righteous indignation in you because you look at the world and you say, how could they dishonor Christ? I remember a missionary, I don't remember his name, but I remember he was describing the temples in India, going to India, looking at the temples, looking at the idolatry, and saying, I cannot live if Christ will be dishonored this way. I would rather die. I just want to die right now. Because Christ is so dishonored, I can't stand it. I remember about 7 years ago, Sarah and I know this couple who have been very influential in our lives. And the lady in this relationship about 7 years ago, I was a baby Christian. She came up to us and she was just broken in her heart because she had just found out that to say OMG, saying, oh my God, using the name of God in that way is blasphemy. She said, I've been saying that my entire life. I've been saying that my entire life. And she just started crying. It's like she realized that she had been blaspheming this entire time. And she, like, her heart was broken. She couldn't believe it. That's the way we should act when we hear God being offended. God being mocked. God being blasphemed. And that's the way that David acted. He was a man after God's own heart. Now, let me ask you other questions. If that's what it means to be a man after God's own heart, or a woman after God's own heart, to reflect God's heart, to see as God sees, do you see as God sees? Does your heart reflect God's heart? Do you love what God loves? Do you hate what God hates? Is your heart broken and grieved for what grieves God's heart? When you hear blasphemy, do you cringe on the inside in pain? It's like, how could someone do that? How could I myself offend God in this way? When you are called to any task, what is it that motivates you? Is it the reward, or is it that God will be glorified? When troubles come your way, when anxiety tries to creep in, when suffering comes to your family, does your heart complain and quarrel against your maker, or do you worship knowing that he is in control and that he works all things for your good and his glory? How do you respond? What is your perspective of things? How do you see life? How do you see life? When you face giants in life, are you paralyzed because of fear, because of the size of your giants, or are you emboldened because of the size of your God? A man or a woman after God's own heart is a man or a woman who sees circumstances and the giants of life and everything that happens in this life the way God sees them, and they trust him. They trust him. Now, verse 28. Now, Eliab, his older brother, heard when he, David, spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, "Why have you come down?" Those are the same words Goliath just said, by the way. "And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" He's saying, "Ha, those few sheep. Listen, David, you are nothing. All you do in this life is take care of those few sheep. And you're so irresponsible. Where'd you leave them?" Keep reading. "I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." Again, he's seeing just like everybody else sees. He's looking at the physical appearance. He's looking at the superficial and coming to conclusions. He doesn't see the heart. Like David does. 29, "But David said, 'What have I done now? Was it not just a question?' Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing about Goliath. And the people answered the same thing as before." So David doesn't even care about what his brother just said. He doesn't even defend himself. He just turns around and keeps asking people about Goliath. And it seems that he was going from camp to camp saying the same thing. And he makes such a fuss about it that it reaches the ears of King Saul. Look at 31. "When the words which David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him." Most likely, David has already been going around telling everyone, "What are you talking about? I'll go. I'll be the champion. I'll go and kill this uncircumcised Philistine." To the point that now it's like Saul is calling for him. And he's probably imagining some mighty warrior, but he gets a 16 or 17-year-old. And you would imagine that as a 16 or 17-year-old, I mean, he would have been shy. I mean, he's going to stand in front of the king. But look at how he acts. Verse 32, "David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail on account of him.'" This is funny. Saul hadn't even said anything. It's like David just marches on and commands the king. He says, "King, let no one be afraid of this giant, and you don't be afraid, king." That's good. He doesn't even introduce himself. He just takes charge. Now, what else does he say? He says, "Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." I love this. He doesn't even ask for permission. He's like, "Listen, I'm getting the job because I'm getting the job. Like, I'm doing it regardless of what you say." He's acting like the king. Everything that Saul was not, he is proving to be. Now, you also need to notice that David's words here are the same words that Caleb and Joshua used in Numbers 13 when they told the people not to be afraid of the giants. And these are also the same words that Moses used in Exodus 14, when he commanded the people not to be afraid of Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And so what's the point? He knows his Bible. Not only does he know his Bible, he believes his Bible. And not only does he believe his Bible, he believes in the God of his Bible. He trusts him. Now look at what Saul says, verse 33. "Then Saul said to David, 'You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth.'" Again, Saul is seeing like everybody else. He's just looking at David. He's not listening to anything David say. He's just looking at him and he's like, "Man, you're not going to make it. You are not going to make it." And notice that this is not merely a remark that Saul is making. This is a command. "You are not going to go." And this is the king who's saying it. Like by this point, there's probably soldiers walking to David. Like they're about to be like, "All right, get out, kid." He said no. And most people would have been like, "Yes, Your Honor," and like they would have walked out. But that's not what David does. David basically brings his resume. Look at verse 34. "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. That's good. This probably happened when he was like 13 years old. So this is a 13-year-old chasing a lion or a bear and taking him by the mane, if it's a lion, or a beard, the beard if he's a bear, and just punching him to death. It's like, that's crazy. David might be a youth in age, but this is a man's man. He is fearless. 36. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. By the way, when he says, again, uncircumcised Philistine, that's an insult. But then when he says it right next to, when he connects him to these animals that he has killed, he's as a commentator put it, he's connecting Goliath to brute beasts. That's how the commentator put it. He was saying to David, Goliath had gone so low in his offense to God that to him there's no difference. He's saying, King, I've killed animals before. This is the same thing. This is the same thing. 37. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. don't get me wrong, King. I have no strength of my own. It is God who will deliver me. That was his confidence, guys. You will hear everywhere. You need to have self-esteem and self-love and self-confidence, and you're good on your own, and you can do whatever you want. You set out yourself to do. If you have any confidence, guys, let it not be in yourself. Let it be in God, in the God that is with you. And even if you have skills and you can have the confidence that you can do a job right, okay, that's good. But even that confidence and even that has to be set in God. And if you have any skill and if you know how to do anything right, it is because God is allowing you to do that. He understood this. David understood this. His confidence is in God. He trusts him. And so after this instance with David, look at how Saul responds at the end of verse 37. He says, go and may the Lord be with you. And for a second, it seems like Saul is actually trusting God. But then look at what he says in 38. Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. So essentially, Saul is saying, go, may the Lord be with you. But let me give you my armor, because without it, you're going to die. Because, you know, I just said that the Lord will be with you, but I don't really believe that the Lord is going to be with you. And so his actions contradict everything he's saying. Verse 39. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. He trusts God. He knows that his God is capable of defeating any giant, and so he doesn't need to trust in Saul's armor. And that leads us to the third and most important fighter, with the coolest name, by the way, Yahweh the Giant Slayer. Yahweh the Giant Slayer. Look at verse 41. It says, then the Philistine, Goliath, came on and approached David with the shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy, with a handsome appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? He's offended. He's saying, how dare you bring to me an unworthy opponent? There's no honor in destroying a kid. How dare you do this? It's like, who do you think I am? And by the way, that shows you that like everybody else, Goliath sees as man sees. All he sees is a physical appearance. He doesn't see the heart, and he doesn't see the God behind David. Also, these words, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? These words may have a certain double meaning to refer to very inappropriate things that paint a picture of Goliath being a very perverted and vulgar and wicked man. And that's exactly what he was. Because look at what else he does at the end of verse 43. It says, and the Philistine cursed David by his gods, therefore revealing again this fight is between the Philistines' gods and Yahweh. 44. The Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. And what's he trying to communicate to David? He's trying to communicate that Goliath is not a passive guy. He's trying to kill David. He's trying to break David and destroy David. But look at how David responds. 45. Then David said to the Philistine, and remember, guys, they're not five feet away from each other. This is a battlefield, okay? Everybody's hearing what they're saying, okay? The Israelites are hearing it. The Philistines are hearing it. So David is screaming out from the top of his lungs. And there's a tenacity and anger and fury and passion in his eyes. 45. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This is the first time, by the way, in the Bible that anybody ever says that he comes in the name of Yahweh. And so David is essentially saying, I'm God's representative, and I'm the people's representative. You've been asking for a man of the between. Here I am. Here I am. 46. This day, the Lord will deliver you up into my hands. Notice the irony here. David's calling Goliath a midget. He's calling him an ant. Like, it's like, you're going to be in my hands, you giant. And I will strike you down. And he's going to do this with stones, right? And that shows you, again, that he knew his Bible, because in Leviticus 24:16, it says that if anyone blasphemed, he had to be stoned to death. And so that shows you why he chose stones, because he knows his Bible. He's saying, you just blasphemed against God. You deserve to be stoned, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So, he says, I will strike you down, keep reading, and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into my hands. It's beautiful. Notice, by the way, that the narrator introduced the first two fighters, but now David introduces the fighter, the third fighter, the most important fighter. This is God's battle. He's the fighter, and he's going to win the battle. Verse 48. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And so he's running as fast as possible. Look at verse 49. And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Can you imagine the scene? There's a million drawings that I've seen of David and Goliath when like David is supposed to like be slinging the sling or whatever you swinging the sling, whatever you call it, okay? And he's in all of the paintings, he's just standing, you know, and he's just doing something small, and he's like, boop, and Goliath just falls. That's not what's happening here. It's like there's momentum here. He's going as fast as he can to the point that it sinks in his forehead, meaning it pierced his skull like a bullet. Verse 50. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. An irony of irony, ironies, the greatest warrior beheaded with his own sword by a hobbit. Keep reading at the end of verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley, into the gates of Ekron, and the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sherem, even to Gath and Ekron. That's about a 10-mile distance, by the way. He doesn't say that. His heart is pounding for the glory of God. And so look at verse 54. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. This is very interesting because Jerusalem had not, it doesn't exist yet. Like, it's there, but it's not Jerusalem. This was a place that was inhabited by enemy people, enemy Gentiles, all right? And so what's going on here is that David is carrying this Gaga ball-sized head of the fiercest giant, all right? And he's parading it around enemy lines. And you have to ask the question, well, why is that? Why is he doing that? What is it? To scare them. Yeah? That's exactly right. He's saying, we're not afraid of you, but you should be afraid of us. We have the mighty God, the living God with us. And my God is so big, so strong and so mighty. There's nothing that he cannot do, even kill Goliath. So don't mess with us. He's undoing what Saul had done, which was bring the reproach to Israel. He's acting like the king. Acting like the king. And sadly, look at how Saul ends up. Let's just read the rest of the chapter. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this young man? And Abner said, by your life, O king, I do not know. The king said, you inquire whose son the youth is. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand. Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. It's as if they're being introduced all over again. And the picture is that of an incompetent king who cannot even remember the young men whom he loved to hear play the harp. And on the other side, a young man holding by the hair with his bloody hands, the head of Israel's enemies. It's a sobering picture. An incompetent king who just lost his kingdom, and a victorious king who just gained the kingdom. And for the very first time in our study, we can say that the king has arrived, but not the ultimate king, guys. Again, who does David represent? Christ, right? Christ. And Goliath represents our greatest trouble, our greatest problem, the wrath of God, death, sin. And who are you? Who do you represent? Who are you in the story? LeGray? Hey, that's good. Yes, exactly. The Israelites. You want to know who you are in this story? You want to find yourself in this chapter? You're the weak, fearful, cowardly Israelites being afraid of Goliath. Defenseless. They don't know what to do. We need a man of the between. That's exactly who we are. And so Christ arrives, and he is our man of the between, and he is our champion, and he is our deliverer and mediator. And so now we can say, oh, death, where is your sting? Oh, grave, where is your victory? I am saved, and I am not saved because of anything I did. I'm not saved because I'm David. I'm saved because Christ paid my debt, and he died in my place. It's amazing. And then lastly, guys, I told you that the theme here is that God is capable of destroying all your giants. Do you trust that? Do you believe that? Do you see as God sees? Do you look at your circumstances and say, regardless of what happens, I can trust the Lord that he will work all things for my good and his glory. And that doesn't mean that he's going to take all your giants away, all your problems away. It just means that he's going to work all things for your good and his glory. That he's in control of everything, that he's good, that you can trust him. Trust him, guys. First in your salvation and then for the rest of your life. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for this story. Thank you for this account. Thank you for the great power that you show here. That you are capable to defeat all our giants, the greatest of giants. They are nothing in front of you. You are so strong and so mighty, and we ask you that we would stand in awe of you and that we would fear you so that we would not be afraid of anything else, that you would be our fear, that you, in you our trust would be placed. Make us men and women after your own heart. May we see as you see. Give us a heart that reflects your own heart for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.